Welcome to the Latter Gay Stories Podcast, the show that features real people, real stories, and real talk. Now, here's the voice of the show, Kyle Ashworth.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Latter Gay Stories Podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Ashworth, and you are at the intersection of sexuality and religion, where it meets at the streets of LGBTQ Avenue and LDS Street. Thank you for giving us an hour of your time, and thank you for joining us on another fantastic episode, just a little bit different this time. Typically, Latter Gay Stories features individual stories of queer individuals or those at this intersection who share their experiences, but today is going to be a little bit different. We have a book we're going to talk about today, and you may have seen it kind of in the Mormon LGBTQ blogosphere and kind of Mormon circles about it's a memoir about D. Michael Quinn. And for many of you, that name will be super familiar. But for some in the Latter Gay Stories audience, that name is brand new. And I want to talk about who Michael Quinn was, the impact he had on this particular topic, especially queer experiences and Mormon history within kind of this Mormon sphere, and a bunch of other things like trailblazing and history and excommunication and queer experiences and so much that involves Michael Quinn. I couldn't do that all on my own. So fortunately, we have Barbara Jones Brown and we have Moshe Quinn, who's actually Michael Quinn's youngest son with us in studio today. So thank you to both of you for joining us on Latter Gay Stories.
Thank you for having us. We're so excited to be here.
Now, Barbara, tell the audience a little bit about yourself. You're the director of Signature Books. Tell the audience who and what Signature Book is and does, and why Michael Quinn.
Yeah, so Signature Books was founded in 1981. It has a storied history of sharing histories written by historians about Mormon history and Utah history. And coincidentally, D. Michael Quinn was one of our leading authors before he passed away in 2021. He published several books with us, several groundbreaking books on Mormon history with Signature Books. And so we're now honored to be publishing Michael's memoir posthumously.
Moshe, your dad was D. Michael Quinn, the famous, and in some Mormon circles, infamous. What's it like growing up, and what memories do you have? I mean, we can clearly jump into kind of the nuts and bolts of the story, but just generally, what memories do you have of this intersection with your father and how that impacted your life, so much so that you're helping to promote the book?
Yeah, yes, there's a lot to unpack there, but I guess the sketch that I'll offer is the fact that I'm the youngest of four. There's like an 8-year spread across the siblings, and my parents were married until I was the age of 8. They separated, divorced, you know, at that time. And a couple of years after that, our father came out to us kids. And from the divorce onward, there was just a close association, you know, between myself and my father and, you know, my father and all of us. And then also my mom and my dad, it was a very amicable divorce, very amicable separation. There wasn't any bad blood as far as like we could see it. And it was really a great blessing and a really great gift to be able to maintain a real sense of family feeling and continuity in those years after the divorce. For example, every Christmas, he was always coming to be with like all of us, you know, including my mom, the household with my mother, our mother. As far as like D. Michael Quinn, the famous or the infamous historian, yeah, that's a major strand of what I think about and what I was influenced by. And the thing that as I was always most influenced as a boy, like this sort of like boy perception that I had was the sense of his being very dedicated and very committed to his faith, and to the church that he loved, the church that he believed in, but also the church that he saw with his clear-sightedness as a historian and as a truth teller, a church that had some things that they were not facing themselves, some facts that they were hiding, some aspects of their own history that they were concealing and didn't want to look at. And he felt really called in a deep deeply personal and also faith-driven way to engage with those truths, because he felt the best service to the church that he loved was to look at everything, even the uncomfortable truths. And so I, from a very young age, had a very strong impression of him as a truth seeker, a truth teller, even though there was a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and a lot of blowback that he experienced and that he suffered from, ultimately, you know, being excommunicated in the early 90s by his church. So I always really admired him in that mission-driven aspect of his life, you know, being a truth seeker and suffering consequences for it, but doing it from what we could see, very pure motives that were very admirable and very inspiring to us.
Now, Barbara, you both of you actually come at this story from positions of allyship.
Absolutely.
At this intersection. You also have a gay son, if I remember right. Your Moshe dad was obviously gay and separated from your mom because of that. So I think all three of us in the room have a kind of a sincere and candid understanding of how difficult, how joyful, how interesting this intersection really is. Sometimes heartbreaking, sometimes super joyous, exciting, invigorating, life-giving, but also for some difficult and often not worth talking about or mentioning. And so as we talk about Chosen Path, I want to kind of keep that in focus. How and what does a queer reader get out of this book? And so, Barbara, you as a mother, what do you see as a reader of this memoir, and also the mother of a queer child? What can we learn from Michael Quinn?
I think one thing that people will realize as they read it, Michael was born in 1944, and so he was really at the forefront, or he was a pioneer, if you will, in queer Mormon history. And as I read it, and many parts of it are just heartbreaking of what he experienced as, you know, realizing he's gay as a boy and deciding to closet his homosexuality. Believing what the church was teaching at the time was that you could pray the gay away, that if he fasted and prayed enough, and he would fast for 72 hours at a time often as a growing teenage boy who needs to be eating, stories like that are really heartbreaking. And then just what he experienced throughout his life. And then finally realizes as an adult, he is exactly the way he's supposed to be. God loves him exactly as he is, and that there is no reason for him to try to closet himself or make him any different than he is. And he finally realizes that his sexuality and his spirituality can come together. They are the same. He doesn't have to choose between one or the other, which he was trying to choose when he's younger. So reading his life story in this book, I've also seen how far we've come. We still have a long ways to go, but the changes and how much better it is getting. And I have a vision, as well as Michael did, of where we can go, how things can be in the future. So I think it provides that hope in the end.
I would love to know how we got the memoir. This obviously was now published, as you mentioned, after Michael's death in 2021, unexpected and quick for us, kind of on the outside. Tell us a little history behind the writing, how you found it. Were you aware that it even existed?
Yes and no, as far as like being aware. It depends on who you're speaking with. I mean, it wasn't really much on my radar. That's not to say that it was the same thing for my older sisters. So there was an awareness of, I want to roll back in time a little bit, because the thing for me that's interesting about the memoirs is that, in a sense, it's like a memoir of a memoir, which is like a memoir of him through his life, trying to account for his life and trying to like work out the meaning and the purpose and what his life was really about. And he was writing about his life like in a diaristic way. You know, he was very committed to a project of diaries and journals starting from his late teens, in earnest his early 20s. And it was a consistent thread through his life while he's researching Mormon history topics. He's writing about his life as a gay man who's in the closet, but then also as a professional historian and as a faithful Mormon. And so the memoir that we have right now is, it's like an interesting, I wouldn't say distillation per se, but it has a relationship and it's kind of in conversation with this history of his self-writing. And one of the things that sticks with me about my father is that he really understood the world through writing, like we all do. Like we think and we process, we write something to figure out our thoughts and our emotions. He did that in a rather concerted way. And I think a lot of that has to do with his struggle, his being closeted, and being able to write about himself for himself was a way to process, I think. I mean, this is my own theory, a way to sort of process and understand and try to resolve, you know, the struggles and the contradictions that he felt he was in, you know, facing. So he was writing for decades. I encountered a version of his, like a version of his autobiography that was 40 pages long in the late 80s. It was maybe 88 when he shipped it to us from New Orleans, where he was living at that time. This is after the divorce, a couple of years. And major strands of that autobiography at that time in the late 80s was his sexuality and the closeting of that, the self-denial that he chose at the age of 12 in order to be a good Mormon, in order to be an upstanding Mormon, in order to be a Mormon who could contribute meaningfully to his church. And at that time, at the age of 12, which is like, you know, 1956, he felt he had to make that choice. You know, they were mutually exclusive and incompatible identities. And that really landed with me because I was 12 years old, literally when I read that. And so I'm the same age as this version of my father who made this choice for himself at the age of 12. And speaking of like progress that we make and, you know, times being different, my perspective on this in the late 80s is like, well, what nonsense. I mean, this is just nonsense that the world is such that you felt like you had to make that choice. And it was really just hard and just difficult to see that was the case for my father in 1956. And to me, it just seemed like an absurdity and a tragedy. So to answer your question, to get to the point of like, well, where did this come from? Well, he had been like working on versions of his memoirs for years and continued on with it. And in 2010, he had this like finished version, which is much like what we see in this published text. And he shared it with friends and family members. He sent me a CD-ROM of it myself, but I was busy just, you know, being who I was and not reading and not looking at everything that he was sending me. So it went into a box and I kind of forgot about it. But my older sisters read it and engaged with it. My sister Mary talked with him a number of times about it. He shared it with some friends of his. And as we know, as we understand, we don't know the details of it, but he did send it to some publishers at that time. We don't know who. It was just something that he shared with my sister Mary in a conversation. So we don't have any details about that. But he did send it off, you know, to some publishers. And, you know, I guess we suppose it didn't quite catch on with those publishing houses at that time. So then after he died, there were some people that were expressing some interest in what they knew of or had heard about his memoirs. And so we found his laptop, which is this old thing. It weighs as much as like a small car. I mean, that's an exaggeration. I couldn't think of a better. It weighs as much as like a brick or something. So it's like this old laptop from, I don't know, the mid-90s, a PC. And we had to like, you know, find these files. And everything is WordPerfect. Maybe no one in your audience has heard of WordPerfect, but it was a very popular word processing program decades ago.
Yeah, I see a lot of people dropping off the feed now.
So anyways, we had to like, you know, convert these files and like be able to read them. And, you know, it took us a while to actually figure out like which files were relevant to a memoirs project. But then we, you know, ascertained that after a few months. And then we asked around, you know, with some people who might be interested in it. And of course, Signature Books was one of the first, you know, publishing houses that came to mind because of the longstanding association. Signature Books has been a household name, you know, in our home, you know, because of that longstanding association. So when we touched base with them, and especially touched base with Barbara when she started directing the publishing house there a few years ago, it just seemed like it was a really good fit. And it has felt like a good fit for sure in how this has all unfolded.
I felt really lucky. I started, my first day with Signature Books was March 1st, 2022. And the first manuscript that landed on my desk was D. Michael Quinn's memoir. And I knew who Michael Quinn was as a Mormon historian myself. And I was like, D. Michael Quinn wrote a memoir? You're kidding me. And so it's just been such a pleasure to edit this book, working with Moshe, and then to bring this story to the world.
And that's kind of where I want to take the audience now, is a journey of the D. Michael Quinn pedigree. How does he come in on the scene? I want the audience to better understand who he was. Now, we've said a lot about him being an historian, having a strong desire to be very spiritual and connected and Mormon. You talked so much, what you talked about regarding these binary choices that we all struggle with. Your dad experienced those in the 1950s, and it's so interesting that here we are a whole generation later, and we're still talking about binaries. Our society, both civilly and religiously, is still fixated on binary choices, on things that are either right or wrong, are black or white, are male or female, or we can add any descriptor. But interestingly, like, these are things that aren't unfamiliar to people in a kind of a queer experience, but also just a general experience, how that applies to so many of us and how we face these intersections. But more importantly, I want to discuss your dad as the historian who worked under Leonard Arrington, who provided and gifted the Mormon world so much. And then I want to talk about what happened to him, particularly in the 1990s, how that intellectual Michael Quinn become at odds with the institutional Mormon church. So I don't know who wants to take that, but I would love for our audience who isn't familiar with who Michael Quinn is to better understand why we have such a lofty novel, a lofty memoir about who and what he was.
Yeah, but I can start. We can just go back and forth because there's a lot to say there. First of all, I'm not one who studies Mormonism per se. I'm not really in the tent. I'm not even post-Mormon as far as I consider myself. I stopped going to church when I was 10. And there's just a lot that I don't know about, you know, church culture and church history. Being that as it may, from what I have seen over the years of my father's career and what I understood of it, one thing that stands out to me as a major theme and strand is how feminism was an element in what he wrote about. He took some interest in women's roles in the church and women and something to do with having the power of not prophecy, the power of the priesthood. Thank you. Yeah, the power of the priesthood, which they still currently do not. But there was an article that he published in the 80s where he was, and you could speak to this probably better than I can, but from what I recall, he was looking at some teachings from the 19th century about women and in marriage and by virtue of matrimony and a temple sealed or church sanctified wedding union, women at that time were taught to be understood as having the priesthood, you know, sharing that priesthood with their husband. And that was a bit of a grenade, it seemed like, being thrown into the current understanding in the 1980s, and which still persists today as to the spiritual powers or different kinds of spiritual powers that women have, compared to men in the church. And that was a major thing that was like an element, as I understand, that was behind what eventually resulted in his excommunication. There were other things as well. I mean, there was a small laundry list, I understand, in his excommunication process. But feminism was a really big part of that. I mean, it's something that I've always appreciated in terms of like thinking about I'm not sure if minority status or minority interest is like the best phrase for it, but those who have less power in an institution has always been something that I've seen my dad concerned about and advocating for in some way. And no, I wouldn't say seeking to represent. I mean, he wasn't seeking to speak for women at all, but he was concerned in general about those who have less power in institutional settings or cultural or societal settings. And addressing that inequity in some way. So I see that example of like the strand of feminism being part of his professional story and his being, you know, on the outs from the church. It touches on this larger aspect that I've always seen and appreciated by my father with regards to power dynamics and addressing inequalities.
I think just to add to what Moshe shared, I think to understand Michael Quinn's desire to be a historian of Mormonism and to go to places and explore themes in Mormon history that no one else had before, you have to understand his origins, his personal origins, his family origins. One of those that he talks about in the memoir is the fact that his father is a Mexican immigrant, but chooses to hide it, even to the point that he changed his name. So Michael's father's true last name was Peña, but he changed it to Quinn and tried to portray himself as Irish. Interestingly enough, he was
Spanish and Irish.
But he was friends with the actor, the famous actor Anthony Quinn, growing up, Michael's father. And so that's where he got the name of Quinn. So his father is trying to hide his true identity. Michael is hiding his identity as a gay young man. And then he starts reading about certain aspects of church history that aren't widely known and learning about those as a young man through books he's finding and so forth. And he realizes he feels that the church is hiding things about its history. And so what he says is in his memoir is because he couldn't get his father to truly identify who he was, even to him, his son, and because he was hiding his identity as a gay young man, he thought, well, at least I'll have the church uncover its secrets. And he says that he later realizes it was some way of trying to resolve these hidden identities if he could force the church to acknowledge some aspects of it, of its own history that it wasn't grappling with yet.
I think that's really interesting. And I think the first thing that starts coming to my mind is to better understand someone like Michael, you have to understand what it's like to be a minority within a minority.
Yes.
Because that's very much what he was. And I think you described that really well. Like his pedigree was such that there were layers, like an onion, some hidden and some not yet found. And that was in his fabric as well. But to be a queer, gay young man in a church, especially in the 50s and 60s, that's ultra homophobic. We're talking about, historically, we're talking about Ernest Wilkinson, president of BYU at that point. Wilkinson at that time is saying, if any of you within the sound of my voice at this campus identifies as gay, if you'll please just let us know that you are, we'll refund your tuition in full, allow you to exit the college, and we do that not because we don't think you have a place here. It's because we don't want to be contaminated by your presence. That is the atmosphere that exists in the late 50s, early 60s. Electroshock therapy is taking place at BYU's campus in the basement of the Smith Fieldhouse building. So it's not a favorable place to be queer. But yet, your father still remains a minority within a minority and still holds on to this identity. The long way around that, my question really is, what makes Michael Quinn relatable, believable, or even more importantly, viable in this space. What was so special about Michael Quinn that today we have a memoir and historically we have an untold treasure trove of works with his fingerprints on it?
I think we could both speak to that, but I think he was prolific. He was brilliant. He was very smart. He did love BYU academically. He had a lot of fun at BYU. He really enjoyed his friendships and experiences. He wasn't out yet, of course, at that time, but there was a lot about BYU that he loved, and again, particularly the academics. And so he pursued that passion. He figures out that he wants to become a historian. He gets his PhD at Yale. He loves Leonard Arrington, who was a famous church historian of the time, and Leonard Arrington becomes his mentor. He has so many doors open for him in history, and he is bold and brave and wants to go where no one's gone before, and is prolific. He's published, I can't remember if it's 7 or 8 books on Mormon history that people that are into Mormon history, they all know D. Michael Quinn, and he's famous for his books and his footnotes, long, well-researched, documented footnotes. So I think because of his bravery in doing the things he did and how much he published and on subjects that had never been explored before. Perhaps his most famous book is Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, and he talks about Joseph Smith's involvement in black magic and the occult before he moves more into mainstream Christianity. That was a groundbreaking work, and so many works like that.
Groundbreaking because the church had hid that portion of its history so deeply and really Fort Knoxed it so well that average Latter-day Saints had no clue that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon via a rock and a hat. And now we're even to the point today where we see videos of Russell Nelson, current prophet of the Mormon Church, with his head in a hat, explaining how Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon.
And that's where Mike wanted the church to go. He would say, look, people need to know about this. People need to hear about this. And let's just make it a non-taboo subject so we can talk about these things. And then these things aren't so scary or taboo. And so that was what he pushed for. He was just ahead of his time. He's pushing for this in the 1970s. And it puts him at that time in crosshairs with leaders of the church.
Yeah, and I mean, to add to that, it touches on what you were saying, Kyle, about a minority within a minority. And it gets me thinking about the idea of like one definition of activism is speaking truth to power. And that's, I think, like a really, I think, a useful way to think about my father's career. There's other ways as well, but like I think that's a useful lens. He really was not speaking truth to like what he saw as an oppressive power per se, didn't like view the church that way. But he saw there were some issues with these concealments, these things that the church wanted to hide and bury, and how it was hurting the church, he felt. And it was a disservice to its members and to the community of faith. And so he felt mission driven to speak truth to power, to reveal the truth, even the uncomfortable, the awkward, the unfortunate truths, and to be honest, about all of that in order to serve his faith tradition. And another thing that I think about is like in terms of like a larger theme, for anyone who has felt like a little bit alone in the midst of conventional wisdom or in the midst of like a larger picture of, people messaging things to you or norms being conveyed that seem to like make you feel isolated or make you feel judged or make you feel alone in so many ways, in so many intersectional ways. My father lived through those experiences and struggled through those experiences, but like really like came out, I really feel strong as one who had a sense of his own beliefs, like whether it was like being a socialist Democrat, going to BYU, in the late 60s. Being a working collar kid, as he saw himself, a blue collar kid, a working class blue collar kid, as he saw himself in the context of, moving amongst some elites, in Salt Lake City. In so many ways, you know, he really felt like he was on the margins or in a minority kind of status. And he, I feel, worked really bravely and really courageously, pushing through those situations and ultimately advocating for, and if not directly advocating for, at least being a really powerful example, you know, for many people in similar kinds of situations where they might feel marginalized or they might feel like the status quo is telling them to be quiet. He's a really beautiful example of not being quiet and, you know, sticking to one's convictions and one's morals and one's beliefs for a greater cause.
Yeah, it was such a great lesson. I as I'm listening, I don't ever love to give like spoilers away or the whole point of the book. I appreciate a good cliffhanger. But I do want to ask you, Barbara, as an historian in this space who has studied Mormon history, who yourself have written extensively about these topics, what surprised you in the memoir? Something that you said, aha, or I didn't know that, or were intrigued?
So there's so many things, but just to pick out one example, one story. He was so well connected. This was before he came out, and he was married to Moshe's mother, Jan, four children, a BYU professor, so forth. He was so well connected with the elites of the church to the point that President Spencer W. Kimball, I think he was an apostle when this started. He might have even been the president of the church by the time this started, but he was so well connected that President Kimball invited him to come to his home and go through his journals. And so Mike Quinn goes and he has lunch with Camilla and Spencer. Camilla makes some fried chicken. They sit down, they have lunch together. And he goes there a few times and is just going through President Kimball's diaries. And back then, you would just put them on a typewriter. He was just typing them out on his typewriter. And President Kimball set up a card table next to his desk in his office for Mike to be working on these things. So that was the kind of inside connections that he had. That's how well established, that's how well thought of he was as a Mormon historian.
And I thank you, because I think that, I mean, that draws such intimate detail.
Yeah.
And you can see that connection and how Michael really became relevant in this space. But Moshe, I want to ask you the same question, but more intimately as a son. What did you learn about your dad that you didn't know previous?
Well, similarly, I mean, a lot. There's a lot to say there. But to step back, the thing that I still mull over and I'm still thinking about and processing is having such intimate access to intimate stories. And the context there is that our father, he was always present with us in a caring way. He was always very, very loving and very, very clearly loving. And at the same time, there was an emotional reticence, like his own inner feelings, his own inner struggles, you know, of his generation, maybe even like today. I have friends of mine who are parents, and I think they shield their children from things that they feel like they want to shield their children from. So I think there's a natural protection an urge to want to protect your children. But you know, the flip side of that is like, well, you know, maybe there's like some distance or distancing that can result, where, you know, I grew up loving my dad and feeling loved by my dad, but also not knowing my dad, not knowing like what life was really like for him. And so stepping back, you know, this bigger picture of my engaging with the memoirs, it's a remarkable and, I mean, it's also a very moving thing to be able to see him in ways that I never saw him before, and to know him in ways that I never knew him before, because of just the frankness of all that he says and shares about his life. And so that's I guess like the big aha for me is just being able to see my dad in personal ways, how he knew himself in ways that he wasn't able or willing to share with me and with his children.
I want to do a little bit of a dive for a couple of minutes into that personal story. particularly what it's like in a family, a Mormon family in a mixed orientation marriage. This is territory super familiar to our audience, especially to our older audience who is navigating this space without a manual, without a book, only through the lived experiences of other people. Your father was someone who lived a mixed orientation marriage. And as earlier in the podcast, as we talked about binaries, that was a binary that most Latter-day Saints find difficult. Most gay Latter-day Saints find difficult to manage. The typical Mormon message is mission, marriage, children. And those are the prescriptions for the celestial kingdom. For a Mormon man, you serve a mission, you honorably are released from that mission, you find a wife, marry her in the temple, you have children, and from there, the celestial kingdom is just over the horizon. For queer Latter-day Saints, that's a tad bit more problematic. The prescription was to just figure out how to make it work, find a wife, have children, and this all goes away through your righteous church service. What do we learn about your dad, and just personally, this is more candid, about family life regarding mixed orientation marriages, and we know that he and your mom divorced. What were the factors that led up to that divorce? And you alluded earlier that you still had an amicable set of parents, which to me shows the success of being honest and authentic. And the results of that often are happy families, not divided because of this topic. But I want the audience to get to understand life under the Quinn household roof and what it was like being a product of mixed orientation marriages or a mixed orientation marriage.
Well, it was layered and it was mixed. On the one hand, there's a great deal of a feeling of like care and closeness, in our family, two loving parents, two devoted parents, parents who, got along with each other, for the most part. And we had our family traditions, our family rituals, going out to a bunch of, for some reason, this is like a thing that we did not every Friday, but like once a Friday, like just going out to like a number of different fast food restaurants, which is what I guess we could afford. But having the idea of many meals, many small meals, three different stops at three different, eateries in a night. Having a movie night, which was a huge thing. We were really raised in some senses on movies, a really big love of our fathers and something that my mother enjoyed and we all enjoyed together. So, renting VHS tapes and watching videos at home or going out to movies together was a regular thing on weekends. Saturday morning cartoons, waking up with my brother being 2 years older than me, and like starting this ritual of like 7 a.m. until maybe, 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. And our father would be there for a lot of that. And he would crawl into our parents' beds, ready for like that first cartoon that started at 7 we would watch, as a small family. Our sisters were not into it at that point. They were older. So we would have these traditions and these rituals of closeness. Sunday church, Sunday dinner. And then at the same time, I think about the weekdays and, our father, we were living in the Avenues in Salt Lake City and he was commuting at that time to BYU. So I have this memory of, as a young boy, his leaving early in the morning. And his coming home late at night, maybe even missing dinner with us, often in the evenings on weekdays. He was busy researching, he was busy in the stacks researching for a book or for an article. And, in hindsight, I would see that as, an element of absenteeism. And I began to be suspicious of that as maybe like an element of escapism. After he came out to us as gay, and I was like reflecting on those years, and remembering those arguments, remembering the shouting matches, that would happen sometimes between our parents, and being more aware of those elements of discontent and difficulty and stress. We went to family therapy, and the memoir has it stated clearly, but as I recall, it was 84. That we started going to like group therapy, family therapy. And I didn't know. I was like seven or six at the time. And I was just sort of just going along and just participating in this thing that was very new and confusing, I'm sure. But, you know, just like being present with my family. And later on, I learned from our parents, my mom in particular that shared this, is like they knew there was a lot of unhappiness going on. And they thought that we were all miserable. Like they could see that there was a lot of stress and misery with the kids. And so initially, that's why they went to family therapy, so that we could sort of like figure out like how to fix the kids. Like what's up with the kids? Why are the kids acting out? Why are they not getting along? Why do they seem to be upset? And you know, in that picture, they realized at the same time that a lot of this was coming from them. You know, from the contradictions of their marriage, from the compromises, the inherent compromises to themselves individually. Because of the mixed orientation union that they were in. And so that before too long really led to their separation and their divorce, when they just realized that it was untenable, that it was causing more unhappiness than it was actually helping to preserve and maintain happiness, you know, within a traditional family model. So they just, you know, saw the writing on the wall and saw, you know, the facts as they were, and just realized it was too much stress, too much unhappiness, and better to actually call it quits and face some truths, you know, more than they were trying to, not trying, but more than they were able to face. And it actually led to a lot of more happiness, I felt. Like as far as my feeling goes, when they separated, suddenly, like there was like a clearing of the air, you know, like a load a little bit off the shoulders. I mean, still a lot of stuff to work out, like there always is in life, but I felt an immediate sense of relief when they separated. And then in a weird kind of way, like I felt suddenly closer to my father, because suddenly he was like having these scheduled times to be with me and my brother every weekend. It was, you know, dad time. And that was happening like on a really regular basis, and he was really committed to it, and it felt really good for a number of years. And so suddenly we were spending time with our dad in ways that we had never spent before. So there was a lot that I felt that was like an immediate sense of improvement with the separation, which of course makes total sense, you know, in a lot of ways. And there's more that I could say there, but I think I've said enough maybe to offer a sketch of some things.
Yeah, we absolutely don't want to give all the spoilers away, but I like it because I just think of like the multiple scenarios families at this intersection kind of experience, especially within mixed orientation marriages. Having a very intimate memoir like this could probably help some family members bridge the gaps that exist in those memories. And also, just as we kind of trail this story, it gives kind of a plan and an outline to other families who are experiencing this to see how one situation worked and kind of be able to use some of those important aspects that were positive and ended up being beneficial in their own experiences. So I kind of appreciate that part of the memoir that allows the reader to see it in a very upfront and candid way how the Quinn family kind of navigated this journey. And maybe Barbara, to you, kind of meeting at this intersection as well, seeing how this could be an important lesson for other queer people who exist in this space.
Absolutely. And I think also it can be something that cisgender folks can read and understand what it feels like to be queer in the church, what it feels like to try out this mixed orientation marriage and actually see the suffering it causes, what it's like to be expected to be, okay, if you're gay, if you're queer, okay, but just be celibate your whole life, and just reading from a person's perspective that's experiencing this, how none of those things are healthy or good. And I hope it increases compassion in the cisgender community, the straight community, and increases allyship. I was just saying to Moshe as we're driving up here, I think it's through hearing each other's stories especially stories of people who are different from us, people whose experiences are different than our own, that we come to love each other and come to appreciate each other and come to understand each other and have compassion and come to a place where we want to just only support and affirm each other.
I love it, because that really is kind of the length and breadth of what I want to do here at the Latter Gay Stories podcast as well, is to allow people the opportunity to have the platform to share their story exactly where they're at, without filter, unscripted and unabraded. Just give people an opportunity to really share their experience. And from that experience, my hope is that the audience, the listening audience on the other end of the story, is able to navigate their own journey with a few extra tools, with a little bit more insight, with a little bit more understanding as to who they are, what they are, and the opportunity available to them. I always and often say the three-ring circus, the mission of this podcast really is to help people know that they're not alone, mm-hmm. that they're not broken, and that their best days are ahead. And we often find that in this sense of community. And I want to kind of shift the interview to that perspective of the story, but more particular, what Signature is doing in this space as well for other queer stories. I know we've here on the podcast, I've had one of my best friends, Lori Lee Hall, who is writing a book with Signature now that I believe she told me it's going to be published in the fall of 2024.
That's right.
Her own personal story as well. Now, Lori Lee Hall is a figure in Mormonism that is, to me, just a beautiful, tragic, heartbreaking, inspiring story. As the chief architect for the Mormon Church, designing some of Mormonism's most iconic buildings, the Provo MTC, the Provo City Center Temple, it was once a tabernacle destroyed by fire, and then out of the ashes rise this beautiful temple, which really is metaphorical of Lori Lee Hall's story, how she really took who she was, charred it, burned it, reconstructed it, and turned it into a beautiful edifice. And I hope to see all of those lines in this book that she's coming out with. But there's stories about queer Mormon joy that are being published by Signature. I would just like you to give the audience an opportunity to understand what Signature Books is also doing for the space of queer story.
Absolutely. So when I interviewed for the position of director of Signature Books, the owners of the company and the board asked me what my vision for Signature would be. And I said, Signature has done a fantastic job for, you know, decades now, telling the stories of history in Mormonism, mostly of white men, mostly written by white men. So that's great. But I just said, my mission would be to really expand the tent, keep doing that, but expand the tent and have more stories about women, more stories about Black, Indigenous, people of color, more stories of queer Mormons and queer Mormon history, and just expand the tent so that we have way more voices, additional voices being shared. And they picked me for the job, which meant that they picked me because they liked that mission. And so that's what I've been doing from day one, starting with Chosen Path. So we're doing a lot of books that you mentioned, Lori Lee Hall's book, who is a transgender woman and started living authentically a few years ago. Her memoir is going to be so important. Like D. Michael Quinn's, she was intimately connected with church leaders as an architect for the church, and she now is pioneering in her area, as Michael Quinn did in his. We also are publishing a book called The Book of Queer Mormon Joy, edited by a lesbian woman named Carrie Spencer Prey, who is post-Mormon, married to her wife now. She has collected anthologies of BIPOC folks across the BIPOC spectrum and international spectrum and LGBTQ spectrum, sharing their stories of finding queer joy. But I'm also expanding the tent in terms of racial experiences as well. So we're talking about right now a book We're tentatively calling Black and Blue at BYU, talking about Black students' experience at BYU and the history of racism on BYU campus. So again, it's just part of a larger, a broader mission to expand the tent and include all kinds of stories.
I love it. And Carrie's so talented and gifted. And
she is, yeah.
Also a product of a mixed orientation marriage.
Yes.
And an amicable divorce.
Yes.
And so I just think that these are all positive stories that absolutely need to be at the storefront in this space for people to be able to use and benefit from.
I agree.
As we kind of wrap the podcast, first, I just want to say thank you to each of you for vulnerably bringing something like the magnitude of this memoir to the space. Because as we've talked about marginalism and marginalization and being a minority within a minority within a minority within a minority, that also is very true of a book of this subject, because it doesn't appeal to a huge, wide mainstream audience across the globe. When we talk about queer experiences or Mormon history or hiding the facts, I mean, we're really speaking to a very small audience. So the risk is very high in taking a book this specific into the market. But to me, I mean, it's the old starfish analogy. It was worth it to that one.
That's right.
And so as one of those who got thrown back into the ocean, it means something to me. So I just personally want to say thank you. But as we kind of wrap the podcast, what haven't we talked about that you want to talk about or you want the audience to know, either personally or about the memoir or about the path forward? Maybe I'm just saying the time is yours to speak directly to the audience.
Well, I'm not sure that what I have to say is like entirely new from what we were saying earlier, but it just gets me thinking of like what is a large takeaway or the largest maybe takeaway with regards to queer identity in this context of a paradigm which is very, you know, cisgendered and even judgmental or marginalizing of queer identity. And times have really changed, which is one thing that I'm thrilled to be able to say. Having, you know, grown up in the 80s and seeing my father, you know, been very intimately exposed to and connected to his struggle and his pain. And not just like what was coming from society, is like how he internalized so much and how he denied himself of his own volition, if you will. Of course, he was influenced by the society around him, but how he denied himself so much in his life. And there's this time in the early aughts when I was, you know, thinking about my father being single. He came out in degrees over decades, but like really publicly he came out since like the early 90s and had no need to like say hide or continue to hide, say, from church authorities with regards to you know, going to gay clubs or being, you know, very publicly seen as a gay man in the world. And he was single for the most part, and he stayed single, and he passed away without being in a long-term romantic connection with a man. And so I asked him once in the early aughts, like, okay, so Dad, like, what is this, and like, what's really going on there? And talk to me a little bit about that, because I'm curious. And he said this thing at the time that was just really, really tragic and really hard to hear, but it was just coming from his life and his heart. He said, well, you know, Moshe, I think that I just spent so much of my life denying a really true part of myself that it just became a deeply ingrained habit, not just in terms of like behavior, but in terms of like how I allowed myself to feel or not feel certain things. And I think that maybe at this point in my life, I realize I'm not able to change that as much as I could hope for. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to be as open emotionally to allow for a sustained romantic relationship, you know, to be there for me in my life. And so, like, for me, I think that that's deeply sad and tragic. But the thing is, like, well, let's at least, like, look at that as a cautionary and as a lesson that we can take into our lives, especially with the world being so much better, and yet there's a lot further to go. But our father, I really feel like, was part of this generation that did a lot to pave the way, you know, for more opportunities, you know, for more acceptance. But also his way of like denying himself and having that sad part of his life continue through to the end, looking at that as a cautionary tale and like really like, you know, being empowered by that, I hope, as a cautionary tale, to have compassion for that and to say, okay, well, what can I do in my life, extending compassion to myself and also all those around me so that this doesn't happen for other people moving forward.
I think it is beautiful, and it's a great way to kind of capstone this whole message. We've been talking about The Chosen Path, the memoir by D. Michael Quinn, on today's episode, and I think we've just been super fortunate to have both Michael's son, Moshe Quinn, and from the publishing company Signature Books, Barbara Jones Brown, an author yourself, here to discuss it. Where can the audience find the book?
So we always encourage people to buy local. And so we encourage people to first check with their local bookstore. And it is in a lot of bookstores here in Utah. But again, it may be in Barnes & Noble, whatever state you're in. But try to buy from a local bookseller. But online, it's available on Amazon. And I believe the audiobook is also now available if you prefer audiobooks. If it's not, it's coming soon. And it's also available on Kindle. So anyways, basically just Google Chosen Path, a memoir by D. Michael Quinn, and you'll find all kinds of ways where you can get your hands on a copy.
And if your local bookstore doesn't have it, you could request a special order.
Exactly.
And you can still buy it from your local bookstore.
Call your local bookstore. That's right. We just did a book signing last night at Benchmark Books in Salt Lake City. And so they have signed copies by Moshe, his sisters, and myself right now. And then tonight we're headed down to Pioneer Book in Provo on Center Street. And so they will have copies available as well. So.
Beautiful. Thank you again to both of you for your experiences, your willingness to bring, again, this book to the marketplace of idea and innovation and understanding. Again, as we discuss kind of the queer experience and the lived experiences of other people, it's always best, at least for me, as an advocate and one who has the ability to promote things like this, to help people learn by the lived experiences of others, to allow them to see an experience that is not their own. And I believe in diversity, and I believe in that better understanding. And again, just want to thank both of you for bringing this to us and giving us an opportunity to engage in a human being that really changed the landscape of Mormonism for the better. And really, at the cost of that was a lot of pain. And I think the audience will be able to see that and understand it through reading the book and really intimately being able to understand who Michael Quinn was. So again, thank you, you two. I wish you the very best.
And I'm
thankful that you looked to the Latter-day Stories audience to specifically say, like, this is a book for you, for the listener and the audience of our podcast.
Well, thank you, Kyle. Yeah, thank you.
All right, again, for those of you who do want to pick up a copy of Chosen Path, a memoir by D. Michael Quinn, visit your local bookstore and pick that copy up. It's a heavy read. It's a great read. So it's not a small, light book. And I will say it's also annotated. So there's plenty of annotations in there that you can follow along. For those of you who are familiar with my On the Record document, I'm a big fan of sourcing. I'm a big fan of annotations and being able to, and maybe that's still the Mormon in me. I don't like seeing just the cliff notes. You have to give me the sources so I know for sure it wasn't taken out of context. And I know Connell O'Donovan.
Yeah, he was one of the annotators. Yeah.
To add these annotations.
Yeah, as did Calvin Burke as well, and also Sue Bergen, who is an ally.
We are familiar and friends with all of those names.
Good so, names, yeah.
Wonderful names who have just deep histories in this space. So,
and can I add, too, really quick,
of course,
the fact that Moshe, his photograph is on the cover. The cover of the book is a photograph that Moshe took.
Yeah, a little strand. My father dabbled in photography. That's not why I became a photographer or pursued it, but it's a lovely... It's a lovely fit and a connection that I feel really honored by, and I like to thank Barbara for actually making that possible, to have my photo as a, I don't know, a kind of like a visual metaphor for the story itself. And so I'm very touched and pleased with that.
And when you read it, you'll know why.
That's right.
Thank you, you two. And thank you to the Latter-day Stories audience who's given us, given your time another hour to better understand the experiences of the LGBTQ community. We want to thank you for doing that. If you, again, want to pick up a copy of that book, Chosen Path, a memoir, we invite you to visit your local bookstore. If you find this episode intriguing, we invite you to share it as well. And if you have a comment or question for Moshe or Barbara, we invite you to leave that now in the comment section. And they're both social media savvy-ish. So with your permission, you can answer some questions and we can forward that along to you as if audience has specific questions. But I also think the audience will be able to get their Michael Quinn fix from the memoir. So I absolutely encourage you to do that. Again, thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for sharing the stories of people, giants like Michael Quinn. But most importantly to you, the audience member, thank you for sharing your individual story that helps us better understand what it's like in this space. It's stories like yours, it's stories like mine, and stories like all of ours that help us continue writing our own Latter-day story.
This episode is a production of Latter-day Stories. We are always looking for new friends. Give us a like on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at Latter-day Stories. The podcast is made possible because of generous donors like you. Make a donation now. Your donation gives us the ability to build bigger bridges by producing more Latter-day Stories. Want more? Find this episode and others online at LatterdayStories.org.